the Ark of the Covenant, found intact in ancient Palestinian ruins. This is from a team of researchers from Duke University and the University of South Florida said Saturday. They have found the first known Ark of the Covenant from ancient Palestine. Now, this doesn't mean the original Ark of the Covenant that was in the temple. This has to do apparently with the Jewish custom of patterning the arks that they used in their synagogues in the later time. It was patterned, of course, after the original one. But the comment is, even though only the uppermost portion of the ark survives, it is the first intact Ark of the Covenant that has been recovered from ancient remains. The ark portion discovered by the team is made of white limestone and weighs a half a ton. It was found at the site of Nebatim in Upper Galilee and features two lions standing astride a gabled roof and scallop shell. Now, there's a further remark here that I wasn't aware of. Eric Myers, who's the spokesman of this team, said the find of the real ark made earlier this year is important because a similar engraving was found last year at Nabatrian on a black ceramic bowl dating back to the 6th century. Now, if that's true, I hadn't seen anything in any papers about the real ark being found. They've been looking for it. They've been digging around in the ruins of Jerusalem and otherwise. But I wasn't aware that any discovery had been made in that connection. This one, of course, dates back to the synagogue days when, after the destruction of the temple, the synagogue service required trying to replace the original ark. And this ark that was found dates from possibly the 2nd or 3rd century after Christ's day. But it highlights something in my mind, I think it should in yours, that the archaeologists in the last 100 years have done more to prove the Bible as being historically correct, and that the Jews did have an ark and worshipped in accordance with God's law. And these evidences give us real reason to have more confidence than we ever did before, if we lacked it in the fact that there's a statement made somewhere in somebody's writings that the stones are crying out, that is, those things that are being dug up out of the earth by the archaeologist are crying out or testifying that God's word is true and that we can depend on it historically as well as spiritually for guidance and understanding. I thought that's interesting to me. Let's think about just a little bit about what happened this week. Plenty happening still. Middle East continues in a state of much uncertainty. And this ceasefire that came about the first to last week is continuing, but it has a most precarious outlook for any real peace. It is actually just a breathing spell, a cessation of hostilities. And those hostilities can again plunge the Middle East into a worse situation than it was in before the ceasefire was brought about. Israel, as we know, has shot down a Syrian plane flying over the southern Lebanese region. And Syrians have vowed to retaliate against Israel when they feel the time's come for them to take those steps. They have vowed to keep their missiles in the Middle East, that is in the southern Jordan region, to shoot down Israeli planes. Mr. Begin, on the other hand, has vowed to see those missiles removed. This Palestinian splinter group, this PLO splinter group we spoke of last week, has continued to hurl rocket shells into northern Israel, killing people, and the Jewish people, the government is very much upset with such a situation as that, but so far they've held off from any overt or forceful retaliation. Mr. Begin, who he thought won an election recently, has tried to consolidate his position, but so far he has not been able to get a majority. He's still working on it, hopefully, because he wants to again be prime minister. But if this majority is not obtained according to Israeli law, he must call another election to see how it turns out. Mr. Sadat, the president of Egypt, is flying to this country this week to discuss the Middle East situation with the present United States administration and try to obtain more support for his position and the uncertain relationship that still exists between Israel and Egypt. With the fact highlighting that Israel is withdrawing from the Sinai, and Mr. Sadat hopes to take it over in a way that will put Egypt in a top position in that part of the world. And so he is anxiously hoping that this country will support his position. However, more importantly, there is a definite trend in this country, in Congress, and in the State Department, to re-examine and to question the continued support of the United States of Israel in the light or because of what they feel is the extreme and dangerous position Mr. Begin, as leader of the Israeli people, has done in the bombing of those southern in the bombing of those Lebanese cities and towns that was so demonstrated on television and impressed people. The Israeli people and government are divided on whether that kind of thing should continue, because they recognize that public opinion the world over is turning against Israel because of this, what the United States, some members of the administration think is a misuse, an unlawful misuse of the weapons and planes that Israel has received from this country. And on the other hand, there are still those, Mr. Reagan in particular, feels that Israel is the only dependable ally of this country in the Middle East. They recognize the fact that the Israeli armed forces, particularly the Air Force, is the most efficient by far in its striking power and in its ability to work in the interests of the United States to try to bring order and stability in that part of the world. But there are those, on the other hand, who question whether, when there is a crunch that they foresee developing in that region, that Israel will be a dependable ally of this country, or whether it will turn in upon itself and look to its own interests. And the reason they feel this crunch is coming is because of the fact that the world is recognizing that Russia's ambitions in that region are, in Russia's far-reaching thought to dominate the world, that their position is to take every advantage of any opportunity that opens for them now that their border is right on what we would call the Middle East, that they can take every opportunity to come into that region with more influence, with more arms for the Arabs, and in an attempt to convince the Arab people that Russia is their friend and not the United States, and that they can be, Russia can be depended on to take a position in their favor, particularly against Israel. Now the Arabic peoples have no reason to trust Russia, and they don't. They have no confidence in Russia as a real helper. They know Russia, any move Russia makes is in her interest and not theirs. But their hatred of Israel and their desire to see the present Israeli government toppled and the city and sovereignty of Jerusalem returned to their hands, the Arabic hands, the temple site, which is, they fear, will one day be violated by the Israelis and another temple built there by the Jews. They're fearful. And their hatred of Israel causes them to, against their own good judgment, look to Russia for more help. And Russia's going to give it at every opportunity that is offered. You know, that temple, that mosque, or its proper name is not the Mosque of Omar. It was built by a man, a sultan by the name of Omar, in the year 637 after Christ. However, that mosque was built on the site of the ancient Temple of Solomon and of the temple that Christ worshipped in, which was built by Herod just before, or it was in the building even in Christ's day. It is a holy place in God's sight. The Muslims think it is holy equally in their sight as the place that Muhammad is supposed to have ascended to heaven on his horse from the rock that Abraham offered Isaac on as a sacrifice. The Arabs have sworn to get back the sovereignty of that city and their, what they consider their most holy place. Jesus, in his reference, if you want to turn to it, it's in Matthew, the 24th chapter. He was a student of the book of Daniel, just as we're studying it. And he recommended that we seek to understand it. And in Matthew, the 24th chapter and 15th verse, says, "When ye therefore see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place," and that holy place to him was the temple of Herod, "whoso readeth, let him understand." Now they saw an abomination that maketh desolate in their day. But there was to be a continuance of the desolation of the temple site after his day. In his day, it was the Roman power that had come down on the land for its destructive work, which later saw the temple laid in ruins. In our day, there's another power ready to come down. It will stand up against, as we are told, the Prince of Princes. We're going into our lesson a little bit here. We're told that it shall be broken without hand. That is, without human agency. God will see to that. And that power is the one we've been speaking of in looking for every opportunity to come down on that region in fulfillment of what we have studied from Ezekiel 38 and 39 concerning Gog of the land of Magog. So there's a great deal working in the direction that we have been studying and that we know has been in the minds of students of prophecy for a good many years. There's a lot to watch. Anyone else care to contribute to this kind of thinking? Well, excuse me. The region of ancient Persia, which is today Iran, is in a most chaotic condition. There's no stability there whatever, and it is ripe for Russian penetration whenever Russia feels that they can get by with it. Keep your eye on that point. Well, we'll go to our lesson if there's nothing more on this subject. We were in the process a couple of weeks ago of considering H, the letter H in the middle of page 57 on the sanctuary cycle. Now, in doing this, we are actually thinking of what Daniel has to say about two little horns, or two horns, that come up in two different parts of the world for two distinct purposes. Now, in the case, it is asked here, is there any relationship between the 2300 days to cleanse the sanctuary and the time, times and a half of Daniel's 7th? There is a relationship, but it takes two different forms from two geographical centers. Let's go back to Daniel 8 on this point of the 2300 days about the sanctuary. Now, we go over these things and we put emphasis on them because in a study like this, unless we keep our lines straight, our thinking straight, and a proper perception, we can become mixed up. So we repeat certain things for emphasis. Now, in Daniel 8, verse 8, we remember the he-goat, which was Greece, and Alexander, in his conquering of the ram, the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. That was Alexander, you remember. And for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Those were his four generals that took over after his death. And they divided his empire among them. And out of one of them came forth a little horn. Now here's our little horn here in this chapter, which waxed exceeding great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. Now to review a point, we recall that was the Roman power that was transferred in a military way, an army that was sent out from Italy and from Rome to take over a bequest that one of the little kings, he wasn't so little at that, at Pergamum, when he got dissatisfied with his higher ruler, he willed this kingdom to Rome and the people of Rome, and they sent their army to take it. And from there, as the scripture says here, they spread out. And they spread out to the point in Christ's time when the Roman power was supreme in the Middle East. Jerusalem was in its hands, the temple was in its hands. And that became, that Roman power in that time, became the little horn of the East, the power that had taken over in that region. That in verse 10, it waxed great even to the host of heaven, which was the Jewish people, and it cast down some of the host and the stars to the ground and stamped on them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. So we have then the development of a a power antagonistic to the Jewish people and their worship. At that time, Rome was pagan, and the emperors were pagan, and they had no use for any people that would not acknowledge their emperor as a god in his own right. Now we want to move over from that thought. Now, in verse 22, and this is an interpretation of what we've just read. Now, that being broken, well, we look at verse 21. The rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn is between his eyes is the first king, which was Alexander. Now, that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and holy people. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many, and shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. Now, when does that occur? Well, it says here, in the latter time of this outworking of God's plan. Now, that latter time would be the end of the 2300 days or years that we've spoken of, which began, again, a review point, back in the 300 years before Christ, 334 and 331 and 332 and 331 before Christ. And 2300 years from that brings us down to our own time and the significant things that took place in the deliverance of Jerusalem from the overrule of the Arabic people and returned it to the Jewish people, a most significant sign. But contemporary with this ending, in the latter time, there was to be another power that would take over in this region, spoken of as a king of fierce countenance. His power shall be mighty. He shall destroy and prosper and affect the well-being of the holy people or Jewish people in that area and elsewhere. Through his policy also, he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes. Now, have we a power in that day whose desire it is to take over in that region? We've just been talking about it. The Russian power is poised, ready to move into this region, to take it over, and to destroy the state of Israel, and to magnify themselves exceedingly in the world. So we feel that there is a justification to think that, and history can demonstrate this, that there has been a continuity of powers that have ruled in the Middle East ever since the overthrow of the Jewish sovereign rule, beginning with Nebuchadnezzar and continuing on down through the Romans. When they overthrew the Israeli people, the Jewish people, and established themselves as the enemies and overlords of Israel, there is a latter-day power to do the same thing. And there's been a continuity of that. If we have time to go into it, we will. However, we're stressing something now. We're thinking here, and we want to remember it, we're thinking of the little horn that came about in the Middle Eastern region, in this area, and proceeded from there on down into Egypt and centered their power in all of this area. A Roman power transferred from Italy militarily here to conquer this region. And so it came to pass. That is a little horn spoken of in verse 9 of chapter 8. And it has to do with the 2300 days of that prophecy. Now we want to establish a relationship in accordance with this question here. Into the seventh chapter, where a different time period, and turn over back over to chapter seven, a different time period and another little horn is spoken of. Not the little horn of the east, which we've been talking about, but the little horn of the west and of what it would do in relation to what had gone on in this region of the world connected with ultimately Jerusalem and the worship that God has in mind to establish there in the latter days. Now we look at chapter 7. We've gone over this to some extent in the development of the power that did arise. And we look at chapter 7, verse 8. Well, we look at verse 7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and great iron teeth. This is supposed to be a representation of it right here. And it devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the other beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, we have a power in the world that corresponds to that power. The Roman Empire, which later was known in history after the dissolution of the Roman Empire as the Holy Roman Empire. Its focus was here in Italy and concentrated in the city of Rome. Thus, it's called the Roman Empire. And its military power in all of the Mediterranean region, North Africa, was very great. It ruled with an iron fist, an iron hand. And it was much greater in its strength than all of the other powers that had preceded it, the world empires. Now, we have here a representation in recording these things. It was the fourth beast, was dreadful, terrible, strong, was related somehow or other to 10 horns, 14 powers or governments. But this little horn, as we're told here, I considered the horns, and we're going to find in verse 8, behold, there came up among them another little horn. Now this is different from the little horn we've been talking about that came up over here. This power was concentrated in Italy, spread out from Italy east and west throughout the Mediterranean region. And before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots, and behold, in this horn were the eyes like the eyes of man, and a mouth speaking great things. All right, we discussed, you remember, and we read from a book by a non-Christadelphian on the power that developed in the city of Rome that became this other little horn. It was the little horn of the west, not of the east, because its power was concentrated to the west of this region. Now, how did that come about? Well, and how is it to do with time, times and a half? Now, let's see if we can find a verse that tells us about that. Turn over to verse 21, or 20. And of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows, I beheld. And the same horn made war with the saints, and prevailed against them, until the Ancient of Days came. Now, how long would he do that? Let's look at verse 24. And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them. And he shall be diverse from the first. He shall subdue 3 kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time. So there we have a time period. Does it have a relationship to the 2300 days? Only in this, that this has transpired in about the same part of the world. Time times and a half we found, and we're not going to again into how we find that. It's based on the Jewish reckoning of 360 days as a prophetic year. Time would be one, times would be two, 720, and a half time would be 180, adding up to 1260 day years. So we have then a shorter time period that runs concurrently with or at the same time as does this 2300 days, but being shorter, it's included in it. It's in, within this 2300 day time period. Now, how did that come about? I think I'm going to read to you a paragraph from Brother Mansfield here, who has a very good presentation of this, and we're going to enlarge on it as we go along. He's speaking now of verse 8, this other little, another little horn. In it were the eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. This horn, or power, persecuted the saints and blasphemed God. It represents the Holy Roman Empire, or Roman Catholicism. Before Rome was divided into 10 parts, it was first divided into two, the two legs of the image here. You can see the bottom part of them. As seen by Nebuchadnezzar, the headquarters of these two divisions were Rome in the west and Constantinople way over here in the east. That's where it is. Now, we haven't gotten to Constantinople yet. This is the first time we've mentioned it. These two centers, from these two centers, there arose two religious systems, the Holy Roman Church and the Greek Catholic Church. The little horn of this verse concerns the former, that is, the Holy Roman Church. There were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. Roman Catholicism was forced upon the peoples of Europe, and when they resisted the supremacy of the Pope, they were compelled by military might to accept his control. Gibbon, in his History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, records how the Emperor of the Franks, known as Pepin, in the year 758, gave to the Pope the states of the church. That is, three kingdoms in Italy. Here are the three horns mentioned in one of these verses. These were confirmed, well, it lists them here, three kingdoms of Italy, the Exarchate of Ravenna, the Kingdom of the Lombards, and the State of Rome. These were confirmed by his son, the Emperor Charlemagne, and represented by the Triple Crown, which is today worn by the Pope, and if you watch TV, you've seen that. Charlemagne did more than anyone else to establish the supremacy of the Pope throughout the world, Europe. And he used his army constantly to that end. In his conquest, three powers, or horns, were completely overthrown. The Heruli, the Ostrogoths, and the Vandals, they were powers from the north that had come down and established themselves in this area after the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, the overthrow of Rome. Now, that needs to be filled in a little bit. Actually, how did all this come about? Well, as we know, there was a revolution in Rome after about 300 years after Christ was born. There had been a struggle between what was then called Christianity, which was suppressed or attempted to be suppressed by the pagan Roman rulers. But as Christianity grew, they allied themselves with people who helped them by force of the sword. And so Christianity became a power in the Roman Empire. And about 300 years after Christ, there arose a ruler that was very, very aggressive and far-seeking in his ability to see the shape of things to come. And he saw the wave of power lay with the Christians. They were making such progress. And so he ruled that Christianity was to become the official Roman religion, to replace the pagan religion. He did not himself become a Christian, or was baptized, so to speak, until his deathbed. He wanted to do what he wanted to do, and then wash everything away at the last minute. That's a very faithful approach to it, but not from God's point of view. However, in his seeking for self-aggrandizement and to become known in history, he conceived the idea that he wanted to leave the city of Rome and established a new, beautiful capital named after him. So he took himself off from Rome and his administration, and he moved over here to a city, Byzantium, it had been known as. And it was in a very strategic location at the Straits of the Bosphorus, emptying from the Black Sea in the regions to the north, over here through the Straits of the Bosphorus into the Aegean and down into the Mediterranean. And he named that city Constantinople, or renamed it, and he made it very beautiful. Well, this city became, we might say, the queen city of the East. Now, when he moved away, he left somebody here of great significance and importance. Who did he leave? He left what was known as the Bishop of Rome in those days. There were several bishops, regional bishops, throughout the Christian, so-called Christian world. There's one down here in Alexandria, Egypt, one over here in Antioch in Syria, one in Constantinople or Byzantium, and there was another one somewhere else, and I can't remember. There were five principal ones. But this fellow here in Rome, he wanted to be the top man, the first, he said, among equals. Well, when Constantine moved his administration away from Rome, that left this bishop in a very, very strategic position. He had ecclesiastical power over all that region. He had established himself, and the people were subservient to him in their worship. There was no other god but the god that sat in the temple at Rome. And he sought power. In addition to his ecclesiastical power, he united himself politically with certain rulers in Western Europe, and they became subservient to him, helping him in his spiritual rule to obtain supremacy in the world. And gave him, as we have read, three very important regions to rule over. The three, the Exarchate of Ravenna and the region of Lombardy and the other one that constituted the States of the Church. Those were the three horns of this region that were plucked up and given to the power of the Pope. He continued to grow. And here's where your times and a half come in. The emperor that was ruling here in the city of Constantinople felt it was expedient for him to recognize the Pope of Rome as the supreme ruler over the destinies of mankind in an ecclesiastical or religious sense. And in the year 533, that's about 200 years after Constantine had moved over here, the Roman Emperor Justinian declared that the Pope of Rome was to be, or rather the Bishop of Rome, he was known as, was to be the supreme ruler over mankind in a religious sense. And that declaration was very important to this Bishop of Rome. It enabled him to attain to a position of rulership over the destinies of nations and rulers. And he attempted to increase his power very greatly. You remember 2 weeks ago we read to you the history of the development of some of the decretals and the authoritative statements that were made by the popes of Rome or the bishop of Rome that declared his supremacy over the well-being of all mankind, that all the world should be subject to him. Now, if we think of 1,260 years from the time that this first declaration was made by Justinian in the year 533, and we add to it 1,260 years, we come down to a very significant period in the world's history. We come down to about the start of a great French Revolution that shook the world as nothing else had done up to that time. It also shook the power of the church. After 1,260 years, the church began to lose. They suffered very greatly a setback at the hands of the French revolutionary people. They threw off in France the power of the priests and of the Pope. And in the process of time, the Pope actually became a prisoner of Napoleon, who was known as the child of the French Revolution. So we have the beginning of a period of decline in the church, beginning with the French Revolution. Now, did it continue? Yes, these things often continue to develop in the plan and purpose of God. In about the year 606 to 610, there was another emperor sitting on this throne in Constantinople, and he went a step further than did Justinian. He declared that this man was no longer to be just Bishop of Rome. He was to be the Pope. Pope meaning in Italian, Papa or Holy Father. And thus we have the beginning of the rule of the papacy in the year 610. And this focus, this emperor focus, was one of the most cruel men that ever sat on a throne. But he had the power to make this declaration, and this Pope of Rome thus became the spiritual head, confirmed over all of Christian civilization. His power was supreme. He could take the crowns off kings and remove them and set up another king. When did that power cease? If we take the year 610, in which this Emperor Phocas declared the Bishop of Rome to be the Pope, and we add 1,260 years to it, somebody quick. How much is 1,260 years added to 610? What would it bring it to? Well, if you do that, you can check me. It brings us to the year 1870. Did anything happen that would indicate that the church was going into eclipse and losing power? Yes. In 1870, we've gone over this before to review points. In 1870, the Kingdom of Italy was consolidated. The Pope had called an ecumenical council of all the great men of the church, priests, bishops, archbishops, and so on, for the purpose of declaring him to be the supreme, not only the supreme head, but to be infallible in any of his pronouncements that he made concerning religious principles and the Word of God, because he was setting himself forth as God's vicar on earth. Well, I think we've gone over some points of how they were defeated in this, both by the elements. He had sat on his throne hoping that the bright sunlight would come through and make an aura of light around him. Well, instead, the worst storm broke over the city of Rome that had been in generations, and darkness held forth over all the city at that time. But that isn't the main point. Shortly after this, the Italian people rose up in a revolution and overthrew the rule, temporal rule, of the Pope in Italy. These three horns or states that had been given to the Pope in the year 800 were taken away from him by the Italian people, and the nation of Italy, which had not existed up to this time, came into being in the year 1870. The power of the Pope was not broken or crushed, but it was greatly reduced, and he no longer had temporal power as a ruler. he lost his temporal power. And thus, the time, he lost his ability as a persecuting power to oppose those who taught in opposition to the teachings of Rome, to the teachings of the papacy. And thus, in what developed, his ability to make war with the saints, as we read of here in that 24th verse, or 25th verse, that had ceased. And since that time, the Catholic Church has no longer been a temporal ruling power in the earth, and has no longer been able to persecute those who taught against it. Do you follow what we've said? Is there any question up to this point? I've gone over this quickly. Some of it's been reviewed. But that is the history of this little horn of the West that came to power in times and a half, made war with the saints. Its power was focalized in Rome, aided by the political power of the rulers of the Western world, and brought into power originally by the rulers in Constantinople. Any questions? We don't have much time. We were going to, well, we'll save that for next week.
Rose, you have
yeah.
That's the little horn of the goat of the east.
Reference to Revelation 13, 5 and
17, I think it is, it's shown there as being the church.
Well, where did you get your reference?
All right. That's my Bible here. That's what I was doing here.
Are you talking about the margin?
Yes.
Well, I don't think you can always trust the margin in some of these references. The margin has to be very carefully.
It is 8:24. The empire should be abiding. Down here it says Revelation 17:13. So I won't hear 17:13 in Revelation.
Well, that's true.
Okay.
There will come a time, and we're going into that next week, when that will be fulfilled. And it will be fulfilled by the rulers of this world giving their power to, not to Russia, but to the beast power that will arise when the Russian power is overthrown. We'll go into that next week, Lord willing. Okay? I believe we've been stopped. So next week we'll take up beginning at, letter I.